Welcome to African American Voices. I'm Virginia Voice volunteer reader Renee Jenkins. Today we'll be reading from Ebony and Essence as well as Sheen magazine. Let's start with an article from Ebony.com. It's entitled, Women's Basketball Has Next When It Comes to Growing the Game by A. Sherrod Blakely. With strong numbers rating-wise in just about every metric during the women's NCAA basketball tournament, the WNBA, whose draft is starting today, April 15th, in New York City, hopes to increase the attention as the tides turn in women's basketball. No matter where you go, it's inescapable these days. Women's basketball is no longer an afterthought that's easily forgotten about, and even easier to ignore. As we saw during the most recent chapter of March Madness, the women's game has evolved into a made-for-mainstream TV event, the kind that moves more girls to want to be clutch, like Caitlin, be unapologetically authentic, like Angel, and do the darn thing, like Juju. Oh, and move the needle in unprecedented fashion across just about every metric you can imagine. But the women's game has been strong for a long time. It's just that now, more than ever, the institutional misogyny, homophobia, and racism, while still prevalent, pale in comparison to the game's proven bodies of work. Caitlin Clark, Angel Reese, for example, and the potential for even more growth in the future with access to the best players expanding at a seemingly exponential rate. We will see the latest installment of the game's growth play out today during the WNBA draft in what's shaping up to be the most important draft class in its history. Why is this one so important? Because the attention and adulation that this league has sought for so long is here, and there has never been a better time, a more opportune time, to amplify the women's game than now. We have all seen the eye-popping ratings throughout the women's NCAA basketball tournament, which eventually ended with South Carolina capping off an undefeated season by beating the Caitlin Clark-led Iowa Hawkeyes. Even before the Gamecocks' unprecedented victory, there were undeniable signs of the women's game being on a different plane than past years. The WNBA enjoyed one of its greatest seasons ever in terms of engagement and overall synergy that extended beyond the players and the league's small, tight unit of followers, fans, and influencers. The 2023 WNBA Finals between the Connecticut Sun and the Las Vegas Aces had the highest TV viewership for the WNBA Finals in 20 years, highlighted by a 36% spike in attendance from the previous season. That Nike commercial from back in the day with Lisa Leslie, Cheryl Swoops, and Dawn Staley, the baller Dawn Staley, who preceded the Dawn Staley, better known today as South Carolina's wildly successful head coach, proclaimed, "We got next." Well, next is now for the WNBA. Part of this shift is increased interest courtesy of its current TV deal. With the interest comes increased criticism from men who, for too many years to count, ignored the women's game altogether or viewed it as a less than desirable passing of time, like a root canal. This reality really hits home for black women who are often nailed with a double whammy of bias based on their race and gender. This means the opening comments by commentator Emmanuel Acho early this month were both sad and comical at the same time. "I'm about to give a gender-neutral, racially indifferent take," said H.O. as part of his opening monologue. "This always has an unapologetic apology feel to it. I'm sorry what I'm about to say will offend you, which is different from I'm sorry for what I said. Oh, the double whammy we talked about. And 3, 2, 1. Angel Reese, you can't be the big bad wolf, but the kind of cry like courage, the cowardly dog," Acho said. "Because if you want to act grown, which she has, if you want to get paid like you're grown, which you are, if you want to talk to grown folks like you're grown, which you did post-game when you told a coach from an opposing team, watch your mouth. If you want to tell people to get your money up, then post-game when you take an L, you just gotta take it on the chin. You don't have to agree with him, but there's a certain logic to his words that one can understand. It doesn't feel as though he's fueling a narrative based more on personal feelings than facts until he capped it off with this little nugget. Nobody mourns when the villain catches an L, he says. Here's my problem. This line of thought, this branch of thought, perpetuates a contrived narrative about Angel Reese that too many folks, mainly men, are way too comfortable peddling. She's outspoken, brash, and speaks her mind in ways that make many folks who don't look like her, who don't understand, appreciate, or value her, or women who look like her, uncomfortable. But does that make her a villain? It's a lazy assumption that too many, especially men, are willing to promote over and over again, even if the overall impact of her on the game has been positive. That positivity, for those who are on the come up in women's basketball, will continue to grow and evolve while the predictable misogyny-laced and bias takes will become more of an afterthought and eventually ignored altogether. That article from Ebony.com is entitled, Women's Basketball Has Next When It Comes to Growing the Game, by A. Sherrod Blakely. Also from Ebony.com, we have an article entitled, Black, Pregnant, and Incarcerated, A Dire Problem Within the Prison System in the U.S., by Jessica Ward. Being pregnant and giving birth are amongst the most memorable experiences in a woman's life. The postpartum experience should be one of the bonding between a mother and her child. However, this experience is much different for women who are in prison, shackled until the moment they give birth, with only law enforcement and a doctor present. With no family or support person present, giving birth while incarcerated is one of the most inhuman experiences a woman can go through. The postpartum experience for incarcerated women is not one of mother-to-child bonding. The women are only given 24 to 48 hours with their newborn until their baby is taken away, and they must also endure a period of lactating with no baby to breastfeed and heavy bleeding without access to proper menstrual products. Institutions don't always give mothers who are in the postpartum phase unrestricted access to hygiene products commonly used by mothers after they give birth, underwear, large sanitary napkins, and other items. Some institutions also don't have appropriate waste disposal receptacles for said items. The Prison Policy Initiative predicted that 55,000 women in the United States will be arrested while pregnant this year. In a single year, women in prison had 753 live births, 46 miscarriages, 4 stillbirths, and 11 abortions. Of the 753 live births, there were 3 newborn deaths and no maternal deaths, and nearly a third of the live births were delivered via cesarean section. As laws are being passed to ban abortions and place those who have experienced miscarriages or stillbirths under suspicion for criminal acts, incarcerated women are dying and losing their babies inside of prison walls. The question at hand is, are the health rights of women being violated while pregnant in prison? Many women give birth in prisons and jails every year, but many more give birth in hospitals because most prison medical units aren't equipped to handle deliveries, says Wanda Bertram, communications strategist of the Prison Policy Initiative. Though incarcerated women may give birth inside of hospital walls, these women are often shackled. Restraining a woman by the ankles, wrist, or waist during pregnancy and delivery is medically hazardous, emotionally traumatizing, and unnecessary. According to the AMA Journal of Ethics, pregnant women who are shackled are at an increased risk of falling and sustaining injury to themselves and their fetuses. Most correctional facilities do not have on-site obstetric care. Because of this, pregnant women are typically transported to community-based providers for prenatal care, and women in labor are transferred to medical facilities for delivery. Unfortunately, all too often, prisons do not provide proper pre- and postnatal care to pregnant women, and many prison systems don't even have written policies about how incarcerated pregnant women should be treated, says Bertram. This neglect of pregnant women is likely often illegal because people in prison have constitutional rights to be afforded proper medical care. That's what the Supreme Court decided in a 1976 case called Estelle versus Gamble. Studies have shown that black women are at a higher risk of preterm birth because of economic and social impacts stemming from mass incarceration, as well as population health and health inequities, including the persistence of racial disparities in preterm birth and low birth weight for all black babies, whether their mother is incarcerated or not. Across the country, black women who are incarcerated and pregnant have had complications. A large percentage of Caucasian medical personnel believe that black women have thicker skin or less sensitive nerve endings than their white counterparts. They are often perceived to have a high tolerance level. One can bear witness to same perception as when viewing the interaction of correctional officers and doctors with incarcerated black women. Recently in Florida, a black woman named Erica Thompson, who was 7 months pregnant, was arrested for violating her probation for a traffic citation. According to Thompson, she told jail staff that she was experiencing contractions but was not given the proper attention or care. The baby, named Ava, later died after Thompson prematurely gave birth inside the Allachua County Jail. Attorney Benjamin Crump is currently representing her as she sues the jail for wrongful death of her newborn child. Currently, we know that individuals in the care, custody, and control of the state do not know what to expect during their pregnancies, nor do they know their rights to care. Clear policies are needed to inform standards of care for pregnant people, says Kimberly Haven, a formerly incarcerated individual and executive director of Reproductive Justice Inside, or RJI. With the medical and legal expertise of members of our coalition and informed by the voices of the directly impacted, our organization has developed the first comprehensive model pregnancy policy manual that covers specific subjects such as pregnancy testing, prenatal care, high-risk pregnancy care, miscarriage management, abortion care access, labor and delivery, postpartum care, counseling, and social services. Some facilities create systems so women can pump and store breast milk that can be later delivered to the infant, but most don't allow this. RJI has launched a new initiative that will make it easy for institutions and an individual to pump, providing dedicated refrigerators to institutions. Given everything we know about how important breast milk is for infants, the fact that this is not practiced is, for me, unacceptable, says Haven. Individuals should be given the opportunity, supplies, and education to pump their breast milk according to their body's schedule and to make it available to the caregiver of that infant. Through litigation and advocacy, Reproductive Justice Inside works to secure prenatal and postpartum health care rights in prisons and jails throughout the country, attempting to end the barbaric practice of women giving birth while shackled and protect the health of incarcerated women and their babies. That article from Ebony.com is entitled Black Pregnant and Incarcerated, A Dire Problem Within the Prison System in the United States, by Jessica Ward. Our next article is from Essence Magazine. It's one we started last time, entitled Beauty is Their Name. These eight ladies remind us that black women in beauty are taking over the industry, by Raina Reed Rayford. As a young girl, I used to think I was pretty only when I straightened my natural curly hair. When I grew up, I was devastated to learn that my story is similar to many other black women who, like me, were socialized to aspire to Eurocentric standards of beauty. As the often quoted Marion Wright Elderman said, "You can't be what you can't see." Indeed, there has been a dearth of representation, and the numbers prove it. For example, only 8 black women have taken home the Miss America crown since the inception of the competition in 1921. And for Miss USA, there have only been 12 black women winners since the first coronation in 1950. Meanwhile, 10 black women have won an Academy Award since the first was handed out in 1929, and 36 have been Emmy winners since the first show in 1949. A 2022 McKinsey & Company study reveals that the disproportionalities also exist behind the scene. Less than 5% of all employees in the beauty business are black, from black men and women in entry-level roles all the way up to the C-suite. Fortunately, black women are working hard to change this status quo and increase diversity within the field. Meet 8 powerhouses who are remodeling the industry from the social media scene to the boardroom. Let's pick up where we left off last time with Chitsi Duru, content creator, on-air host, model, and entrepreneur. Duru would tell her younger self to look beyond physical attributes to define beauty. "I've learned that your inner being is what shines and makes you truly beautiful. A dynamic force in her own right, she effortlessly weaves together her New York upbringing and rich Nigerian roots. Passionate about beauty, self-care, wellness, and faith, Duru is not just a creator, she's a catalyst for positive change and empowerment in the lives of those who follow her journey." Next is Jessica Krull. Allure's editor-in-chief, Krull feels most beautiful when she's working out, no makeup, sweaty hair, messed up. "I've learned the strength is the thing I value most." At her current post, Krull leads the development of content for digital, social, and video platforms, including the Reader's Choice Award and Best of Beauty Award franchises. After roles at Refinery 29, Self, and Pop Sugar, plus Essence as an intern, Krull joined Allure in 2019 and became editor-in-chief in 2021. In her first year at the helm, she launched Allure's The Melanin Edit, which explores black beauty and wellness. Then we have Kiwana Grant. At the Director of Beauty and Well-Being at Purple PR, Grant believes that true beauty is a reflection of your soul. "What makes me feel beautiful is giving to others and expecting nothing in return," she explains. "Kindness is beautiful, especially when it's genuine." Previously, Grant served as the director of PR at Partnerships at Osea Malibu, a clean beauty company that features seaweed-infused skincare. Tahara White. For White, feeling beautiful and self-assured means being well-rested, impeccably dressed, and mentally prepared for the next challenge. As the driving force behind marketing agency 19th and Park, and production house 1 Park 9, she masterminds creative strategies for an esteemed clientele that includes L'Oreal, Glossier, Athletica Club, Ulta Beauty, and NYX. Next is Karen Young. When it comes to beauty, We the People founder Young is all about having fun. Beauty is an expression of self, and your whole self deserves to shine. No judgment. The first-generation Guyanese-American entrepreneur says, with a $1,500 investment in 2017, Young launched her brand from her apartment in Brooklyn. Having started its offerings with a razor, We, the People, has since developed a full-body care line and is recognized as one of the most sought-after black-owned brands in the United States. Then we have Alaya J. What makes me feel most beautiful and confident is when I have discipline and intention, says beauty, fashion, and lifestyle content creator Jay. There is so much power in being intentional. During her 10-plus years as a digital creator, she's garnered an audience of more than 3.8 million across multiple social media platforms. Her striking makeup looks, avant-garde fashion, and authenticity have solidified her as an it girl. A true style enthusiast, she has produced everything from makeup tutorials to educational videos on the history of fashion as we know it. She thrives through the process of helping her devoted audience tap into their own beauty and power. And lastly, we have Maya Allen. According to beauty expert and editor Allen, true beauty defines classification. It rises above arbitrary standards, so embrace every curve. Your body is a unique masterpiece. Her work in the beauty and fashion realm at esteemed publications such as Cosmopolitan, Marie Claire, InStyle, and New York Magazine's The Cut has cast her as an influential voice in the industry. The common motif throughout her career has been ensuring that women who engage with her work from all walks of life feel informed, seen, represented, and heard. That article is from Essence Magazine, entitled "Beauty is Their Name." These eight ladies remind us that black women in beauty are taking over the industry, by Raina Reed Rayford. Our next article is from Sheen Magazine, entitled "Something for the 304. Rapper artist Ken the Man spares no secrets in becoming an up-and-coming artist for the 304 by dedicating her craft to herself and most of all her fans," by Anaya Richardson. Ken the Man never thought the name she selected on SoundCloud would become her whole identity for her rap career, but her alter ego quickly became a game changer. "It's just like a demand. When a man walks into the room, everybody knows who that person is, and everybody gravitates to him. So it's a very dominant alter ego," says the 29-year-old Houston rapper. In this same energy, Ken ensures to give herself credit for what it means to put your art first. Starting out as an artist, using lyricist instrumentals as inspiration to imprint her penmanship in a carefree, self-made way, while paying homage to her city in three projects, made headway for the world to show exactly who she is as an artist. Her pen continues to speak for itself during a sold-out tour and by signing with Roc Nation, showing that the well-needed rest will be worth the wait for what it's in store for within the coming months. "Ken had a humble spirit when I gave her well-deserved flowers. It made me recognize she is an artist deserving of everything in the most positive way." Dive into her story. Sheen, how did your music career start? Take me back to the beginning. Ken, originally, I didn't know much about the music business or industry. I'm the first rapper in my family, so I didn't have a blueprint. I learned about SoundCloud from my peers, and I would do freestyles because, once again, I learned about purchasing beats, and I didn't know about all of this stuff. I was like, okay, well, I like to record this stuff, and I really like to freestyle to these other people's instrumentals. Lil Wayne is one of my favorite rappers, so I've always loved his mixtapes. I never knew that I was going to be a rapper. I just was freestyling and stuff with my friends in the car. We get drunk and just be on the way to the club, put on instrumentals. We don't even listen to music sometimes. We just freestyle. Sheen, when people listen to your body of work, how would you describe it? Ken, my music gives off confidence, arrogance, fuck nigga free, ratchet, just free. I just feel like it's everything that a girl would want to say, even the ones that are shy to say it. Sheen, how has it been since you signed with Roc Nation? What would you say differs from being an independent artist versus being signed? Ken, I had a lot of time being independent and a lot of time being signed. I love my label particularly because I feel like they let me be me. They'll never press me for stuff that's not me or try to make me a person I'm not. So it feels very free to have the music you like and people that support it versus trying to tell you, oh, you can't, or I don't think you should drop that. And I love that. That's what I love about being independent. So it just feels the same. I feel like it's cool both ways. I feel like it depends on your situation. You have to make you get yourself in this situation. What was in your mindset when creating your project back to the 304? I'm kind of aggressive in my music, she laughs. I feel like I'm always rowdy and all that stuff. So with this one, I just wanted to be a little calm and cute, like something for the girls to get dressed to, something for the girls to, you know, feel good to any time of the day. You don't have to listen to it at night or after you wake up. You can listen to it morning, noon, and night. Sheen, did you feel it was necessary to bring a certain side of yourself that was present during your other project for the 304s? Ken, yeah, I just always try to switch it up because I feel like What's My Name was a little calmer. It was something that I felt like men could listen to as well. It wasn't super deep and super conscious or anything, but I feel like it was super dark and super aggressive. It was just like I'm rapping and I'm just talking shit. With For the 304s, I feel it was more fun. It was more boppy. It was bubblier. I was still shit-talking, but it was cutesy. Then I felt like back to the 304, and when I was a little sexier, it was more grown, just like kind of calmer. I just always tried to deliver a different vibe, just because I'd be wanting to see what people like. I just never want to do too much of the same stuff, because you never know what'll go. Sheen, let's get into your sold-out tour. Back to 304, and how was it to hear the songs that have been going viral on social media being repeated back to you by your fans? Ken, it was an unbelievable experience because when I tell you I took it back in 2019 and everybody knew my songs, I was thinking about everyone who wanted to see me on tour 2 or 3 years ago, but those projects are old now. I was trying to put myself in their shoes of what they would like to hear. And I hit it right on the money. Every time, like word for word, it is the best experience ever. You just never know what direction it's going to go. You don't know if people are going to be there, know the words, or if people are just going to stare upside your head. So it was like the best. It made me fall in love with performing because they were telling me how good I did, and it was just so warm. It felt so genuine. So it was one of my top 5 experiences of my life. Sheen, has the tour motivated you to continue to go back to the studio and push your pen? Ken, yes, that inspired me 100% because I write everything. I'm one of the last artists that truly goes into the studio and I write my own stuff. So it hits a little different when people are shouting back something that you thought out of your brain. It's just a greater feeling to know that. Like, I don't knock nobody for getting money and having help, but it's just a different type of feeling to know that when they are chanting, yelling, and screaming, all of this stuff is all shit that I thought about between my studio car and bedroom. I never thought it would be recited back to me. I've been giving myself a little break, though, because I'm truly dying right now. I'm giving my brain a time to recharge because I want to give myself the best opportunity to get in there and stay motivated. Sheen, overall, what would you say to your future self to prepare for everything that you've been about to receive based on your dedication in this field? Ken, get your rest, recharge, and a lot of self-care. I would say anything that anybody says that's negative, don't engage in it. Don't even look at it. Don't let it get to you. Be more into positive, put your happiness first, and keep doing what you've done because it's all paying off. It's all going to pay off. That article from Sheen Magazine is entitled Something for the 304 by Anaya Richardson. And that's all the time we have today for African American Voices. I'm Virginia Voice volunteer reader Renee Jenkins. This program is available on demand at www.virginiavoice.org. Have a great day.